You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
So as we start this morning with this series called The Rescue, I just need you to know that we are on part two, and I am picking up a story that we left hanging last week. So if you were not here last week, you can go to mc3church.org and listen, click on Listen to the Point and listen to the first week, and then it'll kind of make sense to where we're picking up in this story. So just be aware of that as we get to it. Before we get to that, I want to ask you for your opinion. So why don't we hit some house lights here? And I want to see how incredibly brilliant you are. However, you are not allowed to Google, Siri, Alexa, or whatever this, okay? So put your phones away for this brief moment. You can pull them back out to look at the YouVersion app for the Bible. But I just want to know what you think that these words mean. So here's the first word. And we might have to factor the unks out in a little bit, because I know how they are. They're like people that study this for fun. And frankly, my daughter, who, like me, reads the dictionary.com blog for fun. Sorry, it's like my thing. But noisome! Noisome! This is noisome, right? What does it mean? Throw it out. What do you think? Yell. Not hands, just go. Bring it. Loud. Annoying. Loud and annoying. Obnoxious. All right, well, the actual definition of noisome is a powerfully unpleasant odor. So, there you go. I had a noisome experience yesterday, but we're not going to discuss what that odor and where it came from. But noisome, so that's what it means. It is not what you thought it meant. How about this word? Enervate. Enervate, right? What Matt, where's Matt? Oh, he's helping ignition. But this idea of the cowbell, right? He looked like he needed a little bit more of enervating with the cowbell. He needs more cowbell. Enervate, right? It means to give energy to, right? What did you say? Anger. Energize. What else? That's it. Okay, so you kind of covered that. Well, the definition of enervate means drained of all energy. Very weak. So if you are enervated, you're feeling like, I don't know, like you stayed out really late to watch a movie on Friday night for your birthday and got home and went to bed at 2 a.m. That's what happens. But on my birthday, I got out of bed at 12:15 in the afternoon. That was my day off. It lined up with my birthday. I stayed in bed. My son Jack brought me breakfast in bed. Then I read my book. It was great. But anyway, I guess I was enervated because I was lacking energy. How about this word? Restive. Restive. Right? Restive. Oh, peaceful. Okay. Restless. Peaceful, calm. Jesus, little baby in the manger. Very restive. Any other thoughts? It means so agitated that you can't sit or be controlled. Some of you have children that are restive. And, you know, maybe you've had like a great, you know, grandmother or something say, "Aw, your children are so restive." And you're like, "Thanks." And then you realize now what it means. So restive. All right, not what you expected. How about this one? Nugatory. You get your Snickers, you break it in half, and it's nugatory. Right? Three Musketeers, what do you think? What's nugatory mean? Nothing? Relating to nougat? Relating to nuggets? Denver? Basketball? No? What? It's just whispering. I'm sure it's a good answer, too. Yeah, relating to chicken nuggets? Yeah, absolutely, yeah. No, actually, nugatory means unimportant, worthless, or futile. Not futile like knights in shining armor, but futile. So not what you expected. Let's get a little more exciting here. How about what's a funambulist? Funambulist. Where are we? There we go. Funambulist, right? This is the person that drives the ambulance of fun. Woohoo, party! Right? Sunny's mushrooms. Okay, all right. I see we're thinking about fun guy like me. I'm a fun guy. Anyway, annoying like me. Someone who has difficulty finding fun. Oh, now we're starting to think here. All right. Any other thoughts? Well, a funambulist. If you were here last summer during our Messenger series, we talked about a funambulist. And all of you, if you were here that Sunday, were actually funambulists. Because a funambulist is a person that walks a tightrope wire. And we had a tightrope strung across the stage that week. And we had an opportunity to kind of commit to following Jesus. And many of you walked the tightrope. And so you were funambulists. So that's what that means. Not necessarily what you thought. Okay, how about this? Next word here. Defenstration. Is this what happens when you and your spouse are talking and you're kind of going at your talking, you're discussing, and you're kind of explaining your side and you keep explaining why you were right over and over and over to the point where you just get frustrated sharing your defense? That's your defenstration. Any other ideas? Frustrated, okay. Other ideas? Finding defense with a speech. Okay. Some thinking going on here. All right. What? War games. Oh, okay. Defenstration. That's what the military generals do with those little things they push with sticks. I don't know why they couldn't move them with their hands. You know what I'm talking about? They have like those maps and there's like little toys and they're like, whoa, and they push it with a stick. Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, okay. I don't know why they can't use their hands. You know, that's, oh, I'm a general. I use a stick. But, feeling something airtight. Okay, actually, no. And if you use this word related to an argument with your spouse, you're in trouble. Okay, because defenstration means the throwing of a person or a thing out of a window. So please do not defenstrate with your spouse. And that just sounds like just gross anyway. Anyway, so no defenstrating anywhere. So that's what that word means. Not necessarily what you expected. Okay, let's have a little bit more fun. How about this one? Crapulist. Well, how was your day, honey? Crapulist. Huh? A bad day in Rome. Crapulist. Okay. Bad morning. It was crapulist. So your doctor says it's time for that that internal scan when you go, and they're like, okay, here's the medicine you need to take. Do this over the next 24 hours, and when you're done, it will be crapulous. Crapulous means characterized by gross excess of drinking or eating, also known as drunk. So someone that is overwhelmed, eats too much, drinks too much, they're a crapulous person. And that actually could tie in a little bit to the actual word. All right, and let's end it with a great one. What does this mean? A vomitorium. School cafeteria. All right. What else? A room that Romans went to vomit. A building that Romans went to vomit. I heard something. A room of vomiting people. Yes. So depending on how many hands you shook this morning and whether their kids were just had a little stomach bug. This might be a vomitorium in a few more hours or days. It could be. We were at Dick's Sporting Goods the other night, and I'm pretty sure that there was a piece of weight equipment made for that. Like it had this thing and handles, and it looked like you'd put it right around your toilet, and just kind of it would just help you. Like it was just kind of, you know how it is. You get one of those really bad stomach things, and you can't even hold yourself up anymore. That's what this was for. So, but actually, a vomitorium, and you were on a right track here. A vomitorium is an exit in a Roman theater. That was what they called the exit, was the vomitorium. So don't know what they did once they exited, but if you need to get out fast, you go to the vomitorium. So all of these are words that were not expected. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But I want to catch us up on the story that we finished last week. And if you remember last week, we talked about how the darkness had settled in and how God created this perfect world. And in through sin, through Adam and Eve, through the fall, and again, you have to listen to that to kind of catch up, things fell apart and the darkness started to creep in. And then we looked at the fact that throughout generation after generation, the Israelite people tried to overcome the darkness by themselves, but they couldn't. But we also saw at the very end that the light was shining and the darkness could not overcome it. And we saw that from the creation of the world, Jesus was there. So I want to pick up right there, because we finished the Old Testament with this idea of the darkness just hanging over and there being no hope and being no way to truly overcome the darkness. And so at the very end of what we were talking about, we said how the people kind of went through a time of being exiled into Babylon, and they were sent there because of their disobedience for 70 years. And then the Babylonians were in charge, but then Persia came in to power. They overtook the Babylonians. And Cyrus issued a decree that said that the Israelites could go back to their land, that they could finally go back to their land after 70 years. And so Cyrus was the king of Persia. And so what we see is Persia permits. And the things we're talking about here are actually from our Word and our Word 3 series. You can listen to them online as well, where we did an overview of the Bible. So Persia permits. Back up. There we go. So what we have here is that Cyrus becomes in control. And the people get to go to their land. And there are three things that happened when they did this. The first one was that a guy named Zerubbabel led a group of people to rebuild the temple, because the temple had been destroyed. And this is where the people worshiped God. And then another guy named Ezra came after him, and he restored the worship of the temple. And then a third group of people went with a guy named Nehemiah, and they rebuilt the walls. So that Jerusalem finally had its place. And yes, this is the solution. This is the answer. But it wasn't enough. And Persia ruled the land for about 200 years. They were the ones. The Israelites lived in Jerusalem, but they were still under the authority of the Persian Empire. And different kings came and went in the Persian Empire. And eventually, this guy named Alex comes along. And he wasn't just an average guy. He wasn't just a good guy. He was great. He was Alexander the Great. And he came along and led the Greek army, the Grecian army, Greek, Grecian, Greco, one of those things, or all of those things, and led them to overtake Persia. And so it seemed like to these Israelite people that finally, okay, yeah, this didn't quite work. The temple worship didn't work. And the Old Testament ended with this temple not working. The trying to do good, trying to earn their way back to God, but it wasn't enough. And so the Old Testament ended with Persia in charge. Then Alexander the Great comes in. And the Greeks did a thing called Hellenization. And the Greeks, this Hellenization was based on Helen, which I don't have time to talk about what that meant. But it was this concept of saying, we're going to turn everyone, we're going to solve everyone's problems by culturally making them Greek. We're going to teach everyone the same language. And so that they all speak Greek and they understand the essence and the beauty and the solemnity and the wonderfulness of what it means to be Greek. So the Greeks gave language. Alexander the Great came in. Greeks gave language. Alexander the Great came in and took over and basically destroyed the Persian Empire. And this guy, Alexander the Great, ruled. The Greeks ruled for about 200 years during this time at the end of the Old Testament. We haven't hit the New Testament yet. And he died at the age of 32. After conquering the entire known world, Alexander the Great died. And so here you've got these people, you've got this nation, this empire that all speaks the same language. And it seemed like, okay, yes, Alexander, he's going to solve the problems for these people that are in darkness. Maybe he's the answer. But when he dies, he has no success plan. There are no, there's no will. There's no discussion of who's going to inherit the kingdom, the empire that he developed. And so it's divided among his four generals. And his four generals that led this army, there's two groups of them. The first group was called the Ptolemies. It starts with a P, so it's actually Ptolemy. So I'd ask you to say that just so you hear it, but the person in front of you, we might have to wipe their head off. So we'll just Ptolemy, just Ptolemy. No. And the Ptolemies, they actually were given the southern area below, south of Israel, in the Egyptian area. So the Ptolemies were Greeks, but they ruled in the area of Egypt. And they were actually not bad to the Jewish people. To God's people, they actually weren't, they were open to this culture of Judaism. They still all spoke the same language. And actually, one of the things that they did is that they created this great library in a city called Alexandria that was founded by Alex. And that's what you do. You name the city after yourself. So they had this great library, and it's actually today known as one of the wonders of the world. And one of the things that was really cool is that the Greeks under the Ptolemies were so interested in being at peace, if you will, with the Israelite people. So they decided to translate the Old Testament into Greek. And this translation process for the Library of Alexandria took only 70 days. And it has become known as the Septuagint, which is Latin for 70. And so it's also the symbol LXX, which is the Roman numeral. So if you happen to be reading your Bible and see a footnote that talks about the Septuagint or the LXX, that's the Greek translation of the Old Testament, because everybody spoke Greek. So this way, now you had an Old Testament written in a language that not just the Jewish people, the Hebrew people could speak, but everyone could read this Septuagint. And so that was pretty good. But there was constant tension between the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids up in Syria. And the Seleucids were led by people called the Antiochuses. There are lots of them. That's the way it worked. Like, you know, George Foreman. You familiar with George Foreman, right? Because of his grill and he boxed too, by the way. He happened to be a boxer. But he named all of his kids George Jr., George the Second, George the Third, George the Fourth, George the Fifth. That's kind of the way it worked back then. So you name all your kids after yourself. Over, like not just Junior, but like all of them after yourself. And so there are these many Antiochuses. No, wait, we're not cussing here. Okay, anyway, they were not favorable to the Jewish people. And so when they kind of fought back, against the Ptolemies and took over the land, they did some pretty horrendous things. They hated the Jewish people. And they tried to get the Jewish people, they forced them essentially to turn and follow their way of religion, which really was none at all, to follow their gods, plural. And so the darkness was growing. It seemed like maybe the answer was the Greeks. That was going to be the way. But under the Seleucids, things were falling apart. And it got to the point where things were so bad that a group of people, a group of strict, let's even say legalistic Jewish spiritual leaders called the scribes, which you'll see in the New Testament, they decided to start a school of teaching, a place where they could teach these people to keep them from being overcome by the Greek, by the Seleucids forcing their way. And that became known as the synagogue. And so during this time, the synagogue, which is a house of teaching, comes into play for the Jewish people. But it wasn't going well, very well. The Seleucids were awful. There was a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes. He was one of the Antiochuses. And so he goes to fight against the Ptolemies in Egypt and loses. And so they're controlling the Israelite people at the time. So they go to Egypt, they lose the battle, they come back, and he's so ticked off that he kills 40,000 Jewish people. You know, that's what you do. You lose your battle, you go back and kill 40,000 Jewish people. And that's what he did. And so the people of, obviously the Israelite people, the Jewish people, were in a horrible spot. And it seemed like, wait a second, God, you said you weren't going to abandon us. God made promises to Abraham. God made promises to Isaac and to Jacob. And this darkness isn't just creeping in, it is getting worse. It is getting horrendous. And the whole world is suffering. And it got so bad that one guy named this, again, this Antiochus Epiphanes, he went to another battle and lost and was ticked off. So he came back to the Jewish temple and sacrificed a pig on the altar, which is kind of like, wow, cool, bacon, you know, ribs. Well, that's fine for us, but Jewish people, a pig was an unclean animal. And it was like the ultimate sacrilege. I mean, it'd be like us, I don't know, coming up and having the band leading a song and thanking Satan for how wonderful he is. Yeah. Whatever you want there. And that's just, it was this ultimate, it was actually a complete sacrilege and a complete horrendous thing. And eventually Antiochus goes again and fights against Egypt. And this time he wins. So he comes back and destroys the temple in Jerusalem. So now this temple that was built by Solomon, which was the center of worship for God. And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago about the temple during, what was the last month? Offer. This temple was the center of worship for the people. It was destroyed when Babylon sent them away. They came back and rebuilt it. And now it was destroyed again. So maybe the Greeks aren't the hope. Maybe Alexander the Great wasn't so great. And so you've got this people, this world, struggling. Because the darkness is growing. The darkness is pervasive. There's no hope. Then it got so bad that we have about 100 years and there's nothing on the screen about this. But during the Greek time, during the Greek rule, there were a group called the Maccabees. And the Maccabees for about 100 years kept fighting back and forth against Greek. They did not want the Greek influence. And so under the Greek leadership, and of course there was obviously the people had some concerns. They were frustrated. And so the Maccabees rose up and revolted. And there's all sorts of things that happened with that, including one where Hanukkah comes out of this, the celebration of Hanukkah. And we don't have time to get into all of that there, but it happened under the Maccabees. But also during this time, because there was so much oppression from Greek, and the Greek kept trying to basically de-religionize, remove their worship of God, that two groups rose up. One group rose up were these really poor conservative people that said, no, we are going to stay strong on the law. We're going to stay strong on what is right. And those people became known as the Pharisees. And so I want you to understand, if you know anything, if you didn't grow up in church and you don't understand where the Pharisees are, no sweat. We'll get to them a little bit later. Not today. But if you did, you know, we always talk about the Pharisees, like, oh, those Pharisees, bunch of jerks, bunch of idiots. They started well. They started well. They came together for a good reason. And so just you know, here we are, six-ish years out from our start as a church. Just because you start well doesn't mean you end well unless you stay focused on what really matters. That's the side. Then there was another group of people. So you had the Pharisees that rose up. But then you had the other group of people that they were like, okay, we want our Jewish way of life, but we're willing to compromise to get it. So they wanted to make sure that the Greeks were pretty cool with them. And so these were rich people because they wanted to make sure they could keep their wealth. And so this group of people were basically sellouts. They were this rich liberal group, and they were called the Sadducees. And so when you get to the New Testament, when you get to the Gospels and you see Jesus in conflict with the Sadducees and the Pharisees, or, spoiler, when the Sadducees and Pharisees come together to kill Jesus, we're like, yeah, Sadducees, Pharisees, yep. No. That was huge. They're as far away, opposite ends of the spectrum they could possibly be. Because the Pharisees saw the Sadducees as a sellout. The Sadducees saw the Pharisees as a bunch of legalists. And they were all right. And then they came together to crucify Jesus. So you had these groups that rose up underneath the Maccabean revolt. And the Greeks led for about 200 years. So there's still this time, and we sang it in one of the songs, this time of 400 years of silence. This time where, okay, the Greeks came in, they're going to solve it. They're making everyone speak the same language. This will be good. And the Greeks weren't enough. Because then a guy named Caesar, or some of you might pronounce it Caesar, if you're all uppity and snotty, but Caesar came in with the Romans and completely decimated the Greeks. And they had the largest empire in the world. And today it's still considered one of the largest empires in the world, depending on how you equate the British Empire over the years, too. But the Romans came in. And now, unknown at the time, this is probably about 100 B.C., 76, 73 B.C., so still about 100 years before this other guy shows up on the scene called Jesus. And the Roman Empire actually lasted for 700 years. But the Romans came in, and the way they did it is that their MO, their strategy, their plan was brute force. Where the Greeks were about education, and we're going to make everyone smarter, we're going to teach everyone the same language, we're going to develop art and learning. The Romans were all about the beat down. And so they had massive armies that were well-trained soldiers, that were extremely brute force. And so the Romans came in, and there was really nothing that the Greeks could do, frankly. And the Romans came in, and this guy Caesar was in charge. And again, you name your kids after yourself. There were multiple Caesars, which is essentially the Roman emperor. And Caesar, not only did they have the brute force, but the way it worked for them is they weren't interested in worshiping other gods or even no religion or anything like that. To them, they had this phrase, Caesar is Lord. Caesar was God. They were to worship the emperor. And so it seems like, yes, the Greeks are going down. The Romans, God, yes, thank you. You're going to solve the darkness problem. And then the Romans came in and said, and you're going to worship Caesar. What? So the Romans came in, and it wasn't quite the same. And the Romans, what they did in order to maintain their dominance militarily was that they created roads. They developed a whole system of roads. And so the Romans raised roads during their time. And so there was a connection. That way the armies could move quickly. And to us, we're like, roads? Like, yeah. And that was a huge new concept, to have a clear path so that their armies could get from place to place. And Rome was known for a thing called Pax Romana, which was a time of peace. That's what Pax means, Roman peace. Pax Romana, it's Latin. And this idea of Roman peace was, it sounds like, oh, that's sweet. Rome had peace with everyone. Yes, because if you didn't agree, you're dead. So they destroyed anyone that decided to fight back, to have any issues. And so they maintained their peace by brute military force. And so the Jewish people are having a problem because they're told to worship Caesar when they know that their true worship should be of God. And now, if they were to rebel, they get beat down by the Roman authorities. And the rules are being put in place that says, look, if you're not Roman, you don't matter. And so if I ask you as a Roman soldier to carry my gear, you are required by law to carry it for a mile. And it's heavy stuff. And this guy Jesus came on the scene and said, hey, if someone asks you to carry it 1 mile, go the extra mile. Because Rome was this dominant authority. And so it seemed like, wow, this is awful. It gets worse. Because Rome put these guys in place, put these guys in charge of the area of Judah, of Israel, of Galilee, this whole area. And they made them essentially governors and said, you're going to work under Caesar and be in charge. And your name, the family name, because they named them all after themselves, was Herod. So you have Herod the Great and Herod Antipas and Herodias. Poor daughter. You know, the Herods were in charge. And Herod the Great was an evil, evil man. I mean, everything you read historically, like they couldn't even tell. There was so much incest in his family that they can't even track any of the lines. Because Herod and daughters and aunts and cousins and grandchildren and all, they were some of his wives. I mean, it was horrendous. And he was this awful, awful guy. And then, just for fun, he decided to go to Rome. And he was sneaky. He was slick. He knew all the right words to say. I mean, he was a politician. And he got Rome to announce to the Jewish people that Herod was their king. Now, you need to understand something here. There was a king. There was David. And there was Solomon. There were all these people in the line of the kings. And for our word three, we talk about how those kings in the line of kings essentially was broken except for this little tattered thread. And let me tell you, Herod wasn't in that line. Herod was not a descendant of David. Herod wasn't even Jewish. And he was claiming to be the king of the Jews. And so Herod is in control. And Herod, again, he did some awful things. What are some of the things that he did? He did a lot of things. I told you about his family. He claimed his kingship by the authority of Rome. And because he was such a slick guy, right? Because he knew that the Jewish people weren't keen on that. They weren't into some guy by using his greed and his indulgence and his awfulness to say, hey, I'm also your king. They weren't cool with that. And so Herod rebuilt the temple. And it was said that Herod's temple, this is now the third time, the third temple was the greatest of all of them. It's supposed to be even greater than the temple that Solomon built generations earlier. And again, if you don't know what that is, if that doesn't make sense in terms of your understanding of what I'm talking about, that's cool. Just get the fact that the temple was where the Jewish people worshipped. And so now Herod, this non-Jewish, not interested in following God, person that is sneaky, that is slick, that is conniving, and has been placed there by the Romans who are saying we should worship Caesar, is now building their temple. It was awful. And so you've got this 400-year period where things are not good. Again, last week we talked about how it seemed like, oh, this is going to be the solution. Oh, this is going to be the solution. Maybe the Persians, oh yes, they're sending us back to the land. This is the solution to the darkness. This is how we're going to overcome the sin problem, the death, the decay, the hurt, the pain, the tragedy. It wasn't the Persians. The Greeks, yes, this will solve everything. Hey, they're even translating our scriptures into their language, in a language that everyone understands. This will be good. Everyone speaks the same language. Nope. The Seleucids made sure of that. Rome. Rome is the solution. Rome is going to fix it. Yes. Caesar is Lord? No. Clearly God said that there is only one God. And I will not share my glory with another. And so here you've got the darkness pervading. And there's 400 years of silence. And the Jewish people are just waiting. And they're not just sitting back waiting in terms of, you know, hey, I got nothing better to do. They're wondering, where are you, God? Where are you? Not only has it been a rough go during the Old Testament, but now we haven't even heard from you for 400 years. The Jews just waited. So the darkness is pervasive. And they're saying, where are you, God? Because we this is not good. We need help. We need a rescue. We need hope. Come, God. Come down here. Show up. Destroy them. Get rid of these people. Rule. Step up. Fix this. Kill. But that's not how the answer came. That's what the people expected, but the answer, just like those definitions, was unexpected. The answer was unexpected. The point for this week is the twist on the rescue comes at the birth of Jesus. See, we've been talking about this rescue story and how last week we said, you know, the rescue from the beginning of time, God had already gotten it in place. And see, the way the Jewish people, the way we would expect the story is like, yeah, and then Big Brother showed up on the scene and had the beat down and Rome was gone, problem solved, everything is good. But that is not the way the story went. It was very unexpected. It was a twist. That's why our line, our dotted line goes all over the place. Because it's not what people thought it was going to be. If you have a paper Bible, you can open it. The lights are obviously on. If you have YouVersion, tap on the YouVersion app. John chapter 1. And this whole series, we're covering John 1. So we'll be bouncing around on it. But John 1 verse 14 says, "The Word," and remember we were talking about the Word last week, Jesus. "The Word became a human being. He made His home with us. We have seen His glory. It is the glory of the one and only Son. He came from the Father, and He was full of grace and truth." So the answer was unexpected. See, the people were waiting, and they were expecting, "God, where are you? You need to show up. You need to beat these people. You need to win. You need to kill them all. You are God. We have seen you do amazing, miraculous things. Remember those plagues, God? Can you bring them back?" But the answer was unexpected. Because, see, for them, when they expected the king that had been promised in the Old Testament, this king that would be in the line of David and would rule forever, they were waiting for that one. And they called him the anointed one, because a king was anointed. They would pour oil over their head as a sign that they are now the next king. And we see this in the Old Testament. It's called the anointed one. There was a Hebrew word for this anointed one, this one who would be king. And that word was Mashiach, or Messiah. And there was a Greek word, because everyone spoke Greek now. And the Greek word for Mashiach, for anointed one, is Christ. So, they're waiting for the Christ. It's not His last name. It's His title. They're waiting for the Christ. And they expect that the king, the Messiah, the anointed one, the Christ, is going to come and win. Because kings rule from afar, and they expected this king to come down. Kings rule from afar. They stay up in their palaces, and they order, and they point, and they tell people what to do. And they're in their moats and their castles, and they've got their authority and their thrones. And this king came down as a baby. This king left His throne, left heaven, and came down not just to His people, not just walking around like some kind of cool, powerful God person that would wink and things would change. It wasn't like Jim Carrey and Bruce Almighty. This king came down as a baby. That's not what they were expecting. Okay. And so that's what we just saw in John 1. That the Word became a human being. And again, last week we looked at the fact that the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God in the beginning, and the Word was involved in creation, that Jesus, from eternity past, before creation, before time, Jesus was there. And now Jesus, God, fully God, becomes a human being. The word means flesh. It says the word became a human being. The other translations say flesh. The word is sarx, the Greek word, because they spoke Greek. So the New Testament was written in Greek because of Hellenization, because of Alexander the Great. The Greek word was sarx. And it says the word became flesh. It means flesh, the meat. And not just He physically had flesh, but everything that goes with our flesh, everything that goes with our humanity, the pain physically, the pain emotionally, all of it, sorrow, sadness, sickness. The Word, Jesus, became sarx, became flesh. He became meat, is another word for sarx. And the Spanish word and the Latin word for meat, and you might have had something like this for dinner in the last couple months somewhere, carne asada. Carne. Carne is the Spanish word for meat. And so we celebrate this idea of God becoming flesh, and we call it incarnation. Incarnation. And we sang that in a couple of the songs this morning. Emmanuel means God with us. And so the Word became a human being. And I need you to get it. We're like, yeah, Christmas. We sing joy to the world. Silent night. We sing all these things, but understand that we are like, yeah, that's cool. That's the way it's supposed to be. That's the way it's always been. Don't mess up my Christmas carols. Like, what's the deal with that? Like, if you're listening to like Murph, and you heard Burl Ives sing another song that wasn't Christmas, you'd be like, what is wrong with the radio station? But it's Christmas time, so we'll play a song from 1957. I don't get that. But anyway, because we don't want to mess with our stuff. Don't mess with our traditions. But it's way more than that. Because the people were like, no, this isn't how it was supposed to be. The king was supposed to come and win and be victorious. But the Word became a human being. He made his home with us. And again, I don't want to go all Greek-y on you. But the Word made his home. Or maybe your translation says, he dwelt among us. The Greek word is skinu, which means to pitch a tent or to tabernacle. And so the Old Testament word, and we did a series called Dwell a number of years ago about the tabernacle. And about how this is the tent where God dwelt among the people until they could build a permanent temple. And so this word, Jesus, the Word became flesh and tabernacled and pitched his tent among us. And he says, and we have seen his glory. It is the glory of the one and only Son. Your translation might say the one and only or the only begotten. And the idea means that this human being born was not like the others. He was fully human, but he also was fully God. He had the glory of the Father. He had the glory of God. He was God. And then John says, he came from the Father, and he was full of grace and truth. And I love that passage, that sentence there. He was full of grace and truth. Because let's talk about truth. It means Jesus didn't compromise. Jesus didn't change things to fit the crowd. Jesus didn't go all Sadducee, like the people, not attitude. He didn't become like a Sadducee or Herod. He wasn't a sellout. He stayed strong. And yet in his truth, he was full of grace, undeserved favor for a people that continue to turn their back on him. He said, no, what is right is right. And what is wrong, and sin is sin. And I will not compromise that, but I will be willing to extend grace to people that don't deserve it. The answer was unexpected. Kings rule from afar, but this king came down as a baby. The second thing that the people expected was that kings conquer with violence. That's what kings do. That's their job. They stay in their palaces. They stay in their thrones, in their castles. And they beat everyone. They send their armies. They send their troops. They send their tanks. They send their chariots. Whatever. But this king extended forgiveness. And again, this is not what the people were expecting, because the darkness had pervaded. It had not just gotten bad through the Old Testament, but now in these 400 years between the Old Testament and the New Testament, before John, before Jesus comes on the scene, things were getting bad. And they're like, Messiah, come. Christ, come. King, come. Destroy. Beat these people. We know how to do it. We've seen the Romans do it. We've seen the Greeks do it. We've seen the Persians do it. We've seen the Babylonians do it. We've seen the Assyrians do it. Shall I go on? We've seen the Egyptians do it. Like, they get it. We've seen the Philistines. They know what conquering looks like, because they have been under the thumb of so many different authorities, so many different empires. And they have been promised by God that they would have a king, a Messiah, a Christ that would rescue them. And so they said, come on, bring it. But instead of conquering with violence, this king extended forgiveness. And basically, this little segment here summarizes the entire Gospels. The Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Four different perspectives on the same story. And of course, we're covering John 1. We're covering John's perspective. But in Matthew 11, we see this interesting thing where if you're following the life of Jesus, everyone's expecting condemnation. They bring a woman who's caught in adultery. The law says she should be condemned. Their law, not his law. And he says, hey, if you're without sin, you cast the first stone. You kill her if you're the one that didn't sin. Extending grace. And then I love that he says to this woman, he says, where is everyone? Has no one condemned you? Because she was caught in the act. If you don't know what that means, it means in the act. Like, she might have had sheets still held on. They might have been like the movie sheets. Special sheets that they have in movies. Because they always like, they're like L-shaped. Because in a movie, the sheets always cover the woman here and they cover the man here. It's just the way it is. But they probably pulled her out of the bed in the act and said, if you're without sin, then you go ahead and kill her because she deserves to be killed, right? And then he says to her, has no one condemned you? He says, then neither do I, full of grace. And then he says, go and sin no more. Truth. He says, I'm not going to condemn you, but what you're doing is wrong. And you need to change it. And we'll talk about what that looks like in a little bit. But this king extended forgiveness, as you look throughout the story of Jesus in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he is constantly, and when people are expecting him to bring the hurt, he brings the love. And we're not talking about peace and flowers. We're talking about a man living in a hard time and extending forgiveness to people. And it got to the point, and we actually looked at this last spring in our series called Less of Me. It was about the life of John the Baptist. And in Matthew chapter 11, Jesus, the way Jesus was doing his thing, the way Jesus was ministering, the way Jesus was being the Messiah, was being the Christ, really confused the people that had been waiting. To the point where John the Baptist, who was considered a devout follower of God, and it's been said that in the Bible, he even calls people aside. This is what we see in Matthew chapter 11, verse 2. It says, John the Baptist, who was in prison, and that was part of the issue too. He's in prison now. Wait, I'm following Jesus. I thought I'm doing the right thing. What's going on? I'm in prison. By the way, he was put in prison by Herod, but not the Herod the Great, another Herod. And he was put in prison, and he heard all about the things that the Messiah was doing. And it kind of threw him off because he expected the Messiah would be conquering and killing and decimating and overthrowing authority and all of that. And so he actually sent his disciples to ask Jesus, are you the Messiah we've been expecting? This isn't going the way we expected it, Jesus. Are you the one? I mean, I thought you were the one, but if you're not the one, just let me know. Or should we keep looking? I mean, it seemed like you were the one, but we expected this kind of violent, kingly, conquering thing, and you're not doing it. Are you the one? Should we expect? And Jesus told them, go back to John and tell him what you have heard and seen. The blind see, the lame walk, those with leprosy are cured, the deaf hear, the dead are raised to life, and the good news is being preached to the poor. Does that sound like an average, everyday person? Probably not. And I am fulfilling the promises that God had made about one that would do all this. I am the Messiah. That's what he is saying. John, I'm not coming the way you expected, because guess what? You guys got it wrong. You expected a conquering king, but I'm coming to offer forgiveness. I'm coming to offer hope. I'm coming because the darkness cannot overcome me. I'm coming because I'm going to solve the darkness problem. So the answer was unexpected. Interesting thing to know about this word that became flesh, this one who comes born as the Messiah, who is born as the Messiah, also known as the Christ, also known as the King, the Anointed One. This one is born as King of the Jews. So this dude Herod, who is King of the Jews, but is not actually Jewish and therefore knows he is not actually king, hears from some wise guys that come to him and say, hey, where's the one that is born King of the Jews? And Herod goes, oh, crap. This is a crapulous kind of moment. Maybe not, because that's not how the word's defined. So wait, there's someone that's really king? And everybody's looking for him? Okay, here's what we're going to do. Okay, go to this Bethlehem area, because that's where they say he's coming from. And why don't you just kill everybody under two? That'll solve it. Kill all the boys under two. Then that way we'll get rid of that king. And that is the whole reason why that happened. Because Herod is not Jewish. Herod is not actually a king. And so he wanted to kill all these people. Because the people expected this king to come and rule afar from his throne. They expected this king to conquer with violence. And the next thing is that kings don't give up. Kings don't give up. Not on purpose. Maybe after being decimated and beaten down and destroyed and having your big thumbs and you only have one thumb, I guess. Your only thumbs and your big toes cut off, because that was the thing they did, so then you could never hold a weapon, and you could never walk well. They would cut off your big toes and your thumbs. And, they would give up eventually. But a king didn't just willingly give up. That's not what a king does. A king fights and fights and fights and fights. And they were waiting for the Messiah. They were waiting for the Christ, the anointed one, to come and to conquer. And this king willingly offered his life. This is not what they were expecting. Why did he do that? Because he could have conquered, but it wouldn't have solved the problem that started in the Garden of Eden. It wouldn't have solved the sin problem. It just wouldn't be enough. There needed to be a good substitute. Something has to die for our sin. So this king came down, and they thought he was going to conquer by violence, by power, by oppression. They certainly didn't expect him to give up. But this king willingly offered his life. And so we find at the end of John, in chapter 18, Jesus was with his disciples right up until this moment. His disciples, his 12 followers, actually 11, because one of them wasn't there, as you see right there. 11 followers, and they were having a meal together, and there was so much built into what that meal was all about. It was about the Jewish Passover meal. And then they went out to pray. They went to a garden to pray. And so they're out in this garden praying, and it says, so Judas, he's the 12th, we know who Judas is. He came to the garden guiding a detachment of soldiers. Why was he guiding a detachment of soldiers? Because the Roman people, the Romans were in authority, and they led by violence. And so they hear about this man, because the Sadducees and Pharisees get together and go to Rome, to the Roman authorities, and say, look, there's this guy, he's stirring up trouble in your Pax Romana. Perhaps you need to help us solve the problem. So now you've got Pharisees, Sadducees, because they're both upset because Jesus is wrecking their world. They come together and they ask Rome to get involved too, which leads to all sorts of trials and issues, which we're not going to talk about today. But they get these soldiers to come. And some officials from the chief of priests and the Pharisees. Like, the whole party is here. The Avengers have assembled. Like, they're all together ready to take down Jesus. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Apparently it was very dark in that garden. They needed torches and lanterns, but weapons also. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, who is it you want? Now, who is it you want? They say, Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. So if we pause the story right there, the assumption will be, oh, they want Jesus. Okay, guys, come here real quick. We'll tell them that guy's Jesus. Or we'll say that Jesus is, he's out at the movies right now. So he's not here. That way they won't get him. Or we'll come up with something. Okay, you go around the left calmly and casually, and then kick that guy in the shin, and then I'll run. You know, like, that's the way the plan is supposed to work. But instead, Jesus says, I'm him. Jesus, wait, do you realize that Romans and Pharisees and Sadducees, they've got torches and lanterns and weapons. They're coming for you. And he willingly says, I am he. Now, there's a little aside here that we're skipping, where Jesus says that and actually makes the people fall to the ground. Which, I don't know, if I'm like, I'm looking for Jesus, and he says, I'm him, and suddenly everyone around me gets blown to the ground, including me, I'd be like, never mind. run away. Like, no. And so it says Judas the traitor was staying there with them. So they come, and it says that they come to arrest him, and they say this. And then, going on in verse, a little bit later in verse 3, or four, sorry, five, one, two, three. Then Simon Peter, one of the disciples, one of the followers, and frankly, a pretty devoted one, sort of. He eventually works out his issues and really leads the church. But Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. Why did he do this? Because kings don't give up their lives. Kings don't willingly offer their lives. Kings don't give up. And so Peter's like, all right, Jesus, you don't got it, but I do. Ha-cha! And then Jesus, it doesn't say this in this version, but again, the Gospels are four different perspectives on the same story. One of the other Gospels talks about how Jesus picks up the dude's ear and is like, puts it back on. Sorry about that. And then he says to Peter, put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? He says, Peter, this isn't how it's going down. I'm coming here to suffer. I'm coming here to be the king. And you think that we're losing. But I want you to know that from the beginning of time, the story was going. And from the beginning of time, the light was in the world and the darkness could not overcome it. And right now you think the darkness is overcoming, but I want you to know it's not. Put your sword away. Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him essentially and took him away. And then he went through multiple trials during the night and he met with the Jewish leaders. He met with the Roman leaders and all these other things. And the thing is that this is not what the people expected. The Jewish people had been waiting for generations and generations and generations. And they tried and tried and tried. And then there was 400 years of silence. But the answer to all their problems was unexpected. Because that's not how it's supposed to work. Jesus is on the scene. But the Word became flesh. The Word became human. Wait, you became like us? God became like us? This isn't the way it's supposed to be. And that was the twist. So this whole rescue story that God has been planning from beginning of time to rescue us from the darkness, from the sin, the twist on the rescue came from the birth of Jesus. Twist on the rescue comes at the birth of Jesus. So the darkness was creeping in. God shows up on the scene. Yes, this is it. This is the answer. This is the resolution. This is the victory. This is the conquering. Jesus, I got my sword at my side. I am ready to go. I'll even bring a lantern and a torch. Because let's do this thing. But God kind of turns it on its head. The darkness not just creeps in and pervades, now it gets worse. And in John 19, it says that darkness covered the land. One afternoon, as Jesus is hanging on the cross. And John wrote, knowing that everything had now been finished. And so that Scripture would be fulfilled, Jesus said, I am thirsty. So a jar of wine vinegar was there. So they soaked a sponge on it and put the sponge on the stalk of the hyssop plant and lifted it to Jesus' lips. He is hanging on the cross. He's been there for about 6 hours. When he received the drink, Jesus said, "It's finished." He said, "It is finished." And with that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. And that's where we're stopping the story today. Because, wow, not only did the darkness grow and the darkness pervade, but now The darkness won. What kind of rescue story is that, God? You made all these promises to us. You made all these promises to your people that you would come and you would solve the darkness problem. And we expected a king that would come and destroy and beat up. And now he's dead. And that's the twist. Not what we expected. Because, spoiler, God knows what he's doing. And we don't. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for your word. And I thank you that, God, I thank you that the story didn't go the way we wanted it. Because if it went the way we wanted it, we would still be stuck. We would still be in need of rescue. But you, from the beginning of time, were planning through the Word, through your Son Jesus, to become flesh, to live as a human being, to extend forgiveness, and to ultimately offer your life on the cross. And I thank you that that is not the way it was expected. Thank you that you didn't do it the way we wanted it. And I thank you that even as we end this story today with Jesus dead on the cross, that the story is not over. Because we're not stuck in the darkness. We have indeed been rescued because the Word was with God. The Word was with God in the beginning. And in the Word was the light. And that life was the light of men. And the darkness could not extinguish the light. And even though it seems that the darkness has extinguished the light, it is not over. Thank you for the hope that we have in this story that we sometimes not intentionally trivialize and become this sweet little Christmas thing. But how it is a plan of amazing rescue. It's in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen.